Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Indeed, today is the day. Today is the National Day of Prayer. It is the first Thursday of May every year, and that means that today, May the 2nd, 2019, is the National Day of Prayer. The theme is love one another. The theme verse is John 13:34. Love one another just as I have loved you. I want you to consider today how it is that Christ has loved you. How is it that God has demonstrated his love for you in Jesus Christ? That's not just a thinking answer, although, you know, thinking right things theologically is important, but it's also a feelings answer. And so how do you feel today about the love of Christ? How do you feel about God's love poured out for you? Grace and, well, I guess, holiness and mercy, holiness and love knit together in what we call grace, poured out on the cross in the person of Jesus Christ. Well, poured into the person of Jesus Christ at the incarnation and poured out in his blood shed upon the cross. How do you feel about that? I was with my small group last night, Covenant Group, and we're talking about a passage from the book of James, and that led us to a conversation about, you know, what does it mean to be people who walk the faith out into the world, not just, again, with right beliefs, but with love in action? What does it mean to actually love one another and not just individually? Not just our individual Christian witness, but our corporate witness as the body of believers. And that's really, when we talk about the National Day of Prayer, we're really talking about what it looks like for we, the collective we, as the body of Christ in the United States of America, to walk our faith out into a broken, dark world and be bearers of light and love other people in order that they might come to know who Christ is. That is actually the prayer of Christ for us as his disciples in John chapter 17. And so we talked yesterday, was it just yesterday, that we talked with the guys from CityServe? And, you know, you should check out what they're doing. If you want to know what it looks like for the local congregation to walk the gospel out into the community and into the world in substantive ways, in compassion. The conversation I had yesterday here with the guys from CityServe was really good. There's lots of great ideas from Love 2020 and Q ideas. There are Christians out there who are doing substantive good through their local congregations and through the cooperative witness of the body of Christ. And so, you know, look for those positive examples today and then get on board and multiply that, replicate those efforts in your own congregation and in your own communities. Okay, up next, Ben Johnson is going to be here from the Acton Institute. He and I have such a long list of things to talk about. I scarcely say that we each probably need just a shot of espresso during the break in order that we can run. I mean, literally, he and I are going to run at a pace through these headlines because there's so much to talk about, not only here in America, but around the world in terms of religious freedom and religious liberty. So that's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
This is my right, a right given by God, to live a free life, to live in freedom.
Indeed, you and I are privileged to live in a nation of freedom where we have all kinds of wonderful rights, including the right to free speech and freedom of religion and freedom of expression. Here to talk with us about all of those things is Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. Welcome back, my friend.
Good to be with you, Carmen.
All right. So I want you to give us a hot take on the Barr hearings and then any reflections you have on the shooting in San Diego.
Yeah, as far as the Barr hearings go, they were more or less a complete bust. I think if anyone who's going into the legal profession who is a Christian, they should take a look at this 5+ hour testimony and study Bob Barr. He is absolutely Bill Barr. He is absolutely a grace under fire. He was subjected to the most terrible kind of character assassination this side of Brett Kavanaugh. He was completely unflappable. He's incredibly competent. And the bottom line was that they didn't have anything to hang on this. He's refused to testify in front of the House Judiciary Committee going on today. Gerald Nadler's threatened to hold him in contempt. But I think he's had enough contempt already.
I didn't really know how to talk substantively today about cow chip throwing. So I was just going to leave it right there. So I thought, thank you for your much better assessment than I would have been able to give. How about, I know you have some reflections on what happened, not only at the Poway shooting, but where people from that synagogue fled for cover. Can you tell people that part of the story that they may not know?
I was kind of surprised about all of this. As it turns out, right next door to the Poway Synagogue, it's a Chabad synagogue 20 miles north of San Diego. As everyone knows, a 19-year-old shooter entered Saturday morning, killed one person, injured three, including the rabbi and an 8-year-old girl. As it turned out, a lot of the people at that Passover service fled next door to St. John of Damascus Orthodox Church. And I have a note that the pastor there posted. It said, yesterday at approximately 11:20, as we were starting liturgy for Holy Saturday, we heard gunshots outside the church. What a horrific experience. We invited the worshipers from next door to lock down in our hall along with our own parishioners. It was not until 3:30 p.m. that anyone was permitted to leave. All of us were traumatized. We celebrate with great joy the feast of Christ's resurrection this evening. Please remember in your prayers those who were affected by this. So this was a horrific event. Thank God they went next door, and thank God the church doors were open. As anyone who's conversant with the history knows, the OCA particularly has some Russian roots. The history between Jewish people and the Russian Orthodox Church has not always been a positive one, to put it in a very understated way. This is what real Christianity looks like. The shooter, John T. Ernest, apparently claims to be a Christian and has been radicalized by people who say that they're Christians but also worship Hitler. And he's justified this in the name of God, but also in the name of the white race. Real Christians shelter people. They respect all human life of every background. They love and shelter Jewish people, and they stand together for human dignity. And we, as all people of faith, whether we're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or any other faith across the world, we have to stand up, join arms, because our places of worship are under attack.
And I felt like I was remembering as you were sharing this, that there was a church shooting at an Orthodox church that would be a Coptic church. And I feel like it was around Easter. And so I'm just imagining that on Holy Saturday, if you are an Orthodox Christian and you are preparing for your Holy Saturday service and you start hearing gunfire outside your church, your first instinct might be to lock your doors, not open them.
This
is a part of the story that I think has not, you know, it's not been told in the mainstream media. So I really appreciate you bringing it to us today. Okay, you have written a piece posted at stream.org. About David Bentley Hart. I'm guessing there's people who don't have any idea who that is, nor why we would be talking about him. So let's jump into that conversation.
They're lucky people. David Bentley Hart's a fellow Orthodox Christian, theologian, teaches at Notre Dame, so he has a fairly robust platform. But on what is our Holy Saturday, this past Saturday, he had an op-ed in the New York Times where he just excoriated everyone who is afraid of socialism or opposes socialism. He says, can't we relax about socialism, was the op-ed. And it's incredibly a negative toward anyone who has the slightest idea that socialism might be associated, say, with what's going on in Venezuela, where tanks are running over the people who elected a socialist government, or where the same thing happened in Tiananmen Square, or any other place that's ever been associated with socialism in the history of socialism. Socialism is instead just benign intentions where the government will help people through government programs, and it's nothing more than that in his telling. So I go through in the piece at the Stream and just go through five different places where he's not just wrong, but he's 180 degrees wrong. And one of them is the definition of socialism. There's a trend that has been pointed out by a counterpart, Christian Nemitz, who is at IEA over in London, that there's a predictable pattern. Socialists will say an up-and-coming socialist nation is the embodiment of socialism. This nation will be the perfect model of socialism. Happened with the Soviet Union, China, with Vietnam, and so on, all the way up through Venezuela. And then they will, after there's repression or genocide or what have you, they will say that was never really socialism to begin with. So that's essentially the sort of 1-2 step that David Bentley Hart takes out. But he's justifying socialism in the name of Christianity, and that's what particularly troubled me.
Well, and I think that we are going to see that. I think we do see it if we're looking, but I think we are going to see that increasingly in the conversations in the lead up to the 2020 election. There are a growing percentage of Americans are willing to describe themselves as socialists, but I think by that they mean they're interested in social justice. I don't think they mean by that they're interested in socialism. And so the rebranding of the term is insufficient to address the underlying issues that socialism foments if people are actually willing to look at what is produced through that system.
Yeah, people are judging it by the intentions, not by the consequences, and which is typical in our political discourse. You always have to look one step further, like a good chess player, to see where this comes out. And where it comes out is where it has always come out. For some reason, every single socialist experiment has ended with corruption and tyranny, as Nicolas Maduro is proving right now. But particularly for an Orthodox Christian like David Bentley Hart, in Russia and throughout the Eastern Bloc, Orthodox churches were confiscated in the name of socialism. The Kremlin became the head of the Communist Party, but it had been a church. You know, all of these things, St. Basil's Cathedral, all of these churches were taken over by the government and declared as government property. Monasteries were shut down. Churches, Bibles, Gospels were confiscated or destroyed, all in the name of socialism. So anyone who claims to be a Christian needs to deal not only with the effects on mankind, which are unbelievably harmful for everyone who's involved with them. People flourish with a free market. But they also need to look particularly at how socialism deals with Christianity, which is always to see it as a rival and to push it out of the public square.
Hmm. All right, you and I got to take a break. When we come back, would love to get your reaction to some other headlines. Nicholas Sandman, who is a Covington, Kentucky high school student who was, in the news last year, has now sued for defamation in federal court, because you actually know what the definition of defamation is. I'm going to ask you to address that, and then we're going to talk about some of the shifting morality of Western civilization. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. My guest is Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute.
Let us pray, let us pray.
So continuing my conversation with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute, you can check out what Ben is doing at, you better give him, it's blog.acton.org. I think if you just type in acton.org, you get there. And so, Ben, jump to this conversation with me. I just learned about this yesterday. Attorneys for Covington Catholic high school student, who we know now is Nicholas Sandman, has announced that they have filed a lawsuit in federal court, seeking, here's the language, accountability for false accusations. They say Nicholas did not instigate a hate crime or engage in racist conduct, which are the things that he was publicly accused of by the media. The stated goal of the lawsuit is the reformation of the media. Talk with us about defamation and then this particular case.
Yeah, defamation legally is the spoken version of libel. Libel is in print. Defamation is in verbal contact. The idea is anything you say that is negative and that is false, that would cause people to have a lower opinion of someone and that causes substantive harm is considered defamation. In order to defame someone who is a public figure, it's almost impossible. You have to have malice aforethought. However, if the person is a private individual, and Nicholas Sandman certainly qualifies, when they doxed him, dragged his name into the public, and then accused him of being the most malicious, terrible person, someone that they wanted to cause physical violence against, certainly that caused a negative impact to him. And in a case like that, the legal standard is much lower. You don't have to show any kind of you only have to show actual damages. You don't have to show that the slights were intentional or that the error was even your own, that you could be passing on an error someone else made, so which is precisely what the Washington Post, which he has already sued, and now he's launching a case against MSNBC and NBC seeking hundreds of millions of dollars in reparations. I would say that it's absolutely clear he was defamed, legally speaking. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't even play one on radio, but I would say if I were them, I would settle.
So this is, I think, the question, because don't you – well, I think it will be – I will be surprised if they settle, because I feel like they are going to have to argue that they have the right to say whatever they want to say, even though you and I would recognize that's not true in relationship to a private individual. They say mean stuff all the time about private individuals, and they're going to really have to learn how to speak differently if they're going to settle this lawsuit. It's particularly if the point of the suit is actually to bring a reformation in the media. If that's really what Nicholas Sandman is going for, which is something that I think would be great to see happen, maybe he wins more for the common good by actually forcing these media companies to deal with their internal, their internal bias. Well, anyway, you and I can leave that there. We've got a lot of shifting morality in Western civilization. There is a case across the border in Canada. Authorities are now poised to arrest a Canadian dad if he, in private or public, refers to his biological daughter, who's only 14, as a girl, as female, as her, as she, or by her given female name. This is shocking to people who haven't been following this case, and certainly troubling in terms of the rights of parents in relationship to the welfare of their own children, but also the overreach of the government in terms of speech.
It is, and this is a question of, as you say, a father who's in British Columbia, and the exact wording of the settlement is the decision that's been handed down by the Supreme Court in his province says, attempting to persuade his daughter to abandon treatment for gender dysphoria, addressing her by her birth name or referring to her as a girl or with female pronouns, whether to him directly or to third parties, shall be considered to be family violence under the Family Law Act. So, calling someone by the name under which the name that you gave them and the pronouns with which the doctor announced your child's birth. Congratulations, it's a girl. If you were to use that noun and the pronouns she or her would be considered violence against someone because it hurts their feelings for a 14-year-old who has been undergoing treatment for 2 years. By the way, one of the things that's buried in this story is the fact that there were two doctors whose names were released as part of this who had encouraged a lot of people to seek treatment for gender dysphoria. One of them is a Dr. Wong who works with a local orphanage system, and as many as 20% of the children, he has said, are suffering from gender dysphoria. 20% believe that they are transgender. The rate of transgender identification in the United States is somewhere between a few hundredths and a few tenths of 1%. So it seems very clearly that an adult is forcing his views on children who are orphans and have no one to advocate for them. And the legal system has effectively made this child an orphan by separating her from her father.
This story is, there may be people who are saying, well, you know, thank goodness that's across the border in Canada. But you and I both know that the shifting morality of Western civilization, which is, you know, normalized through legal means, which is what's happening in this case, the normalization of, what we just might call all bowing down to the LGBTQ agenda is upon us. And if it's in Canada, it's headed south.
Always. I used to work with people who were based in Canada, and they always told me the same thing. Whatever happens here is 10 years ahead of what's coming for you. And they were absolutely right. They, for example, they were dealing with transgender restrooms far earlier than we were, and the exact same arguments, the exact same legal mechanisms and strategies were uncovered, and that's exactly how it was brought into the United States. Here, increasingly in the United States, you see the government inserting itself into the most fundamental relationship that we have, other than our relationship with God, which is our relationship within the family structure. The family is the fundamental unit of society. That's where all the decisions should be made. And quite candidly, the government has no business intervening except in an extraordinary case in which one of those parents or someone within the family is actively abusing someone. And there is no evidence that that is what's happening when a teenager who began at the age of 12, not even a teenager, prepubescent, was pushed into this kind of a thing. By the way, according to Walt Heyer, who is a former transgender woman who reverted back to being a male, he cited statistics saying about 70% to 80% of people who are transgender, who believe that they are transgender, reconcile themselves to the sex in which they were born at some point. So of that small percentage, between a tenth and several tenths and several hundredths of 1%, 80% of those end up reconciling themselves. So should we be pushing these sorts of treatments and the government forcing parents to allow children to raise themselves, essentially? That's what's happening in this country, and it's incredibly dangerous.
Ben Johnson, thank you so much for your perspective. You guys can find Ben at the Acton Institute. We got to take a quick break. So some of you are asking, well, where can I get help if I am a parent in a similar situation to that of the father in Canada to whom you just referenced? And so let me encourage you to go to help4families.org, help4families.org. If you are a parent and you are dealing with a child who is exploring ideas related to their gender identity, if they are sexually confused, if they are gender dysphoric, if you are a child and you are dealing with a parent who is gender dysphoric and exploring alternate ideas to their own identity and sexuality, Help for Families has help for you. So help4families.org. Next up here on Mornings with Carmen, I am going to be talking with Sheridan Voicy. Sheridan has written a new book, The Making of Us. If you've ever been in an identity crisis, if life has ever disappointed, if you have ever wondered whether or not beautiful things could emerge from life not going as planned, this conversation is for you. The book is The Making of Us, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go as Planned. And Sheridan Voicy, the author, will be here next to talk with us.
What were the Old Testament ceremonies all about? And should they still be in effect today? This is Jim Darlow. Ceremonial activity is symbolic. It has meaning, but it's supposed to take you to the issue of the heart. Example, the slaying of the perfect lamb, the shedding of the blood. It represented the one who would eventually be the perfect Lamb of God, that is Jesus. There are certain ceremonies in the Old Testament, like the ones I just mentioned. They were just for that time, and they were not to be done today. Instead, Christians observe the breaking of bread and taking of the cup in a ceremony we call communion. It's no less symbolic and powerful, and the moral components symbolized in ceremonies have ongoing impact and application for all time. Take time to appreciate the ceremonial and let it lead you closer to God. This is Jim Garlow. There's more at wellverse.world.
Recognize his name. The truth of the matter is, you have probably read and been spiritually nourished by something that Sheridan Voicy has written. And that's because he has written frequently for Our Daily Bread. And so if you are a person who has been nourished by the very popular devotional, Our Daily Bread, you have probably read Sheridan Voysey. He is a writer, a speaker, a broadcaster. He's written several books, and he's here today to talk specifically about his new book, The Making of Us, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go as Planned. Sheridan, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Carmen. Thank you for the time.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so here's what I like best. Let me just go ahead and right out of the box. I like best that you have redeemed what may have negatively been viewed in the past as like going west, young man, or running away to find yourself, because you have redeemed it as pilgrimage. And I love that. I love that there is this reason, this legitimate reason for us to steal away and rediscover who we are in God and what God has called us to do next, especially when life does not go as we have planned. So take people to the point in time in your own life that caused you to feel lost, unsure of your future, and then set you on this course.
Okay. So look, way back in the year 2000, my wife came into the kitchen and she said, "Honey, I think it's time." And I said, "Time for what?" And she said, "Time we started a family." And that was the beginning of a journey that so many couples go on, of course. But for us, it turned into a journey of a decade trying to have a family. And you name it, Carmen, we tried it. And in the end, unfortunately, on a very cruel twist to that very long journey, on our very final embryo of IVF, when we'd already decided this is it, if this doesn't work, we're going and moving ahead with our lives as a childless couple. We were actually told we were pregnant. We were told we'd been successful. And then unfortunately, on Christmas 2010, we got a phone call saying, "I'm sorry, you're not pregnant. You haven't been successful." Mm. And with that, my wife put the phone down, walked into our bedroom, curled up in a fetal position, and that's where our 10-year dream of having a child ended. So that was the first thing. I was not going to be able to become a father. My wife wasn't going to be able to become a mother. That's an identity challenge. Now, long story short, and this is actually the subject of the forerunner to The Making of Us, a book called Resurrection Year, we ended up moving from Australia to the United Kingdom. We're living here in Oxford. And it was a wonderful move for Meryn, my wife. She was able to get a job at the University of Oxford, and a great move for her. Proverbs 13:12 says, "Hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a dream fulfilled is a tree of life." And this was a secondary dream for her to come and live and work overseas. But what it meant for me is that everything that I'd been working at in Australia, which had been going very well, being a writer, getting books published, being a speaker, being invited to speak at Australian Parliament House and all of those kinds of things, having a national show in Australia. When I first came to the UK, all of that closed down. And so no longer was I going to be a father, but maybe writer, speaker, broadcaster I wasn't going to have as well. So I needed to find something deeper. Who was I beneath all of those identities? Who was I really? And that's what led to the pilgrimage, which ultimately led to the book, The Making of Us.
Okay, so talk with us about the pilgrimage, the experience, the 100-mile experience, and then talk about Saint Cuthbert and discovering him in the midst of all of this.
Okay, thank you for that question, because I think your listeners are going to love Cuthbert when I've told you about him. So we decided, a friend and I, my friend DJ and I, decided we would do this pilgrimage from a little island in the north of England called Lindisfarne. Sometimes it's called Holy Island. And we would walk 116 miles down to Durham. Now, Lindisfarne could well be called the cradle of Christianity for England. Now, Christianity probably came to Britain maybe the second, even third century, but it really remained a Roman religion. So when the Romans went back in the fourth and fifth centuries, it really died out. It was because of people like Cuthbert and other great saints of old from that Celtic region, people like Hilda and Aidan and Bede, that really the fire of God, the very power of the gospel, actually started to penetrate the heart of the Briton. This is back in the 7th century and the early 8th century. And so we decided to kind of trace Cuthbert's footsteps, really, or in maybe a little bit more detail, we were going to trace the footsteps of the monks that later on took his body, kind of fleeing the Vikings. So they took Cuthbert's coffin and they fled the Vikings. Everything that you think of when you think of Vikings actually comes from their very first raid on England, which was on the little island of Lindisfarne. And so they fled and then finally ended up 100 years later in Durham. Durham now is a huge city with a giant cathedral in it, which has all been built on Cuthbert's life and his legacy. This man, Cuthbert, was an amazing person of faith, a man of the Word of God, loved the Gospel of John, a man of prayer, a man of miracle. He would go into all the areas that nobody else, none of the other missionaries would dare go into, all the warring hill tribe areas, and he would see lives changed. This is the reason why I'm such a fan of Cuthbert, and I think he can be a real hero for any of us today.
Okay, so are you familiar with G.A. Henty and his audiobooks?
No,
I am. Oh my goodness. Okay, so this is now I'm having a moment. Because we as a family learned about Cuthbert through this audio book, The Boy Knight, The Tale of Crusades. It's just so sweet. I will. I'm gonna send you one because we have an extra. So there you go. Okay.
Oh,
so now it's so fun, and you will just the child within me, it just loves G.A. Henty and his audiobooks. So anyway, it's really fun. Okay, so a great way to learn history for all of us who are, you know, still children at heart in terms of learning history. Okay, so talk with us about this redefinition of self. I think that's the way I would describe it. There's a rediscovery of who you are and of God's next call in your life. But then there is this, you know, at some point you have to embrace that and take a step into it. So talk with us about that part of the process. Oh, Paul is now telling me I got to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to continue the conversation that I am having with Sheridan Voicy about The Making of Us. It's his newest book, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go as Planned. So up next, we're going to talk about this rediscovery of self and God's next call in life.
Same power that rose Jesus from the grave. The same power that commanded dead to wake lives in us.
Continuing my conversation with writer, speaker, and broadcaster Sheridan Voicy. He has recently written The Making of Us, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go as Planned. We have talked about his 100-mile journey along the coast of England, inspired by Cuthbert, one of the first monks to evangelize England. And I think let's move to this part. How is it that beautiful things can emerge from life not going as planned?
Yeah, this is really important. Many of our listeners may have gone through or are going through a deep, challenging wilderness experience. It might be like Marin and I that you went through or are going through infertility. Might be that like me, you had a moment where the career just went south. Maybe you've never been able to have the dream career. Maybe you got married and it ended in divorce. You know, by the time we reach our 40s, something probably has gone wrong. And we're asking that question, well, who am I deep down? This is a really important moment when you're going through these deep times. This is actually, I would now say, this is a prime moment for you to discover who you most deeply are. Beneath all of those identities that we normally assume for ourselves, which are normally based on career or parenthood, when those are taken away in some way, we can discover who we deeply are. And for those of us who are Christians, who are people of faith, we probably have memorized 1 John, how great the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. You know, Carmen, I wrote about this. I had, as you mentioned before, I write for Our Daily Bread. I've written devotionals for them about this. I've spoken and preached on this. Did I really believe it? Mm. When it's taken away, then when you discover, all the other things that you've built your life on are taken away, that's when you really discover how deep that amazing truth has penetrated your heart. I had to go deep into that and say, I'm going to live in this, rest in it. I'm going to dwell in it. This is going to be the ultimate source of my sense of self, my sense of security and meaning and purpose. When you can get to that point, then you're not demanding of the work, career, identities or even of parenthood or marriage or anything else, something that those things can't actually give. The second part of the answer to your question is then we follow a God who is a very clever and a genius at redeeming broken things into beautiful things. And I would say that, again, this moment that you're going through, you don't even realize it, but you are sitting on gold. This very event that you're experiencing can actually be building into you all sorts of empathy and abilities and gifts and wisdom to pass on to others when the time comes. I would say, think about what your talents are and then marry them with this trial. Because some of the most amazing ministries in the world, some of the most amazing breakthroughs in the world have happened when people have gone through deep valleys, deep crisis, deep loss, and they've married that trial with their talent. And if we've got time, I can give you some examples of that.
Well, one example just immediately comes to mind. And when you said, you know, it's golden, I'm reminded of the Golden Thread, which is written by your fellow Aussie, Darlene Check, who's been here on the show. And she has talked about, right, this exact same thing. So, yes, give us an example. And then I want us to reserve at least a minute to talk about the creed. So, yes, give us an example.
Yeah, great. Somebody like Johnny Erickson Tada, who many of our listeners will know about, paraplegic as a result of a diving accident way back in the 60s, prayed for healing, never came. But what has been the result? She's married that trial with her encouraging talent. She has a spiritual gift of encouragement, and she has birthed Johnny and Friends, the largest ministry of its kind in the world to help people with disabilities. Just think about somebody like Charles Colson, went to prison for his role in the Watergate scandal. You know, that's a long time ago. And what was the result of that trial? Now, this is a trial he brought on himself. He was the first person to say that. But as marrying that trial with his exceptional statesman and leadership gifts, the result was prison fellowship, which has helped both prisoners and their families and the victims of crime right throughout the world. Those are two big examples. There are multitudes of little examples, little things that happen as a result of just people like you and me, everyday people, next door people, who marry their trial with their talent and so see God redeem the trial that they've been through into service to others. And that's the key. That's where the new purpose comes from.
So at the end of The Making of Us, you actually draw together the lessons that you've learned into what you call a creed. I would love for you to read it to us, and we've preserved enough time for you to read it slowly.
Yeah, thank you. I really wanted to bring together all of the lessons that I had learned through 4 years, actually, of writing The Making of Us. I didn't want to get any cliches. I wanted to work out what is the real essence of all these people that are now following me and reading my books as a result of their own trial. What can we learn? This is what I pulled together. The hand that spins the galaxies brought me into being. The one who holds the stars has made me his own. I am God's child. My life is rich. My days are sacred. I am held by a love that's wider and higher than the farthest edges of this expanding universe. I am a pilgrim in this world, in search of wisdom and wonder. I will take new adventures and follow God into the unknown. What I achieve is not as important as the person I become, so I will seek to imitate the nail-pierced one. I will step in the direction of my strengths and talents. They are spirit-given tools for my God-given tasks. I will pay attention to my persistent aspirations. They could be the whispers of God. I will serve all I can and walk deeply with a few. I will aim for great things, but leave my legacy to God. The path is long and the terrain at times hard. Still, I will not wish for another's life. I will take my place, play my part. Something important will be missed if I don't, for the hand that spins the galaxies wants me here.
Friends, you can visit Sheridan at SheridanVoysey, VOYSEY.com. You can also just type in themakingofus.com. It will also take you to Sheridan's website. And I know that you're going to be asking me, where can I get a copy of the Creed? If you buy the book, then you have this beautifully designed poster version of the Creed that is available for download. So all of the information is there at SheridanVoysey.com. You can also go to themakingofus.com. Sheridan, thank you so much for being with us today.
So good to talk to you, Carmen. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break and then I'll be right back. Today is the National Day of Prayer, and I think that in that conversation that we just had with Sheridan, we are reminded of lots of folks and lots of concerns for which we need to be praying today. So even as you have concerns about the nation, even as you have concerns, I often talk about praying the news, and that's essential and important. And those are things happening in places and to people we do not know. But I also think on this National Day of Prayer, we need to think very close to home and close to heart in terms of the way we are praying for one another. And so maybe you know someone who is in a job transition or having a bit of an identity crisis, as Sheridan just described. Maybe you know a couple who is dealing with the experience of infertility and the grief of acknowledging that they are not going to become parents, certainly not in the way that they had hoped or planned. When life goes in ways that we have not planned, do we trust that we are still walking by faith in the goodness of our Father in His plan? Are we confident of God's sovereignty and of His mercy, of His goodness, and of His grace? I don't know about you, but there are things in my life that have not gone according to what I might have thought of as my plan. And so I kind of abandoned that strategy. And so my plan is to walk by faith each and every day and do the next right thing, take advantage of the next best opportunity that God presents to me to simply glorify Him and edify His people. So let me encourage you in that today. If you are feeling lost or lonely or at a lack of understanding of who you are, know that in Christ, you are beloved. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.